Okay, let's unpack this. Have you ever stopped to truly wonder how much control you really have over your own life?
Mm-hmm.
Are you making every choice freely, guiding your path with, you know, pure unadulterated will? Or are you perhaps more influenced than you realize by forces seen and unseen?
It's a massive question, isn't it? Humanity has wrestled with it forever, that fundamental puzzle. Free will versus determinism. How much is really us and how much is just, well, the inevitable unfolding of everything that came before?
Absolutely. And that age-old debate is precisely what we're diving into today.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're hitting the final chapter of Unraveling the Fabric of Fear.
That's right. Chapter 15, The Law of Free Will, Leading by Example.
Yeah, this is part of our ongoing journey through this really fascinating open collaboration essay. And chapter 15, it gets right to the core of what it means to make choices and, crucially, how those choices ripple outwards.
So let's start with the basics the source lays out, the definition. How does this chapter define free will?
Okay, it defines it as freedom of choice without external pressure, coercion, or fate. It's the idea of acting purely on your own, like unaffected discretion.
Pure, unconstrained choice.
Got it.
And determinism on the other side.
That's the counter-argument, the theory that all events, including our choices, have preceding causes. Everything is the inevitable effect of prior causes, which suggests that, ultimately, free will is an illusion.
And the chapter starts right off with this really stark example.
The Charles Whitman case.
Exactly. A man with, well, no real history of mental problems who commits these horrific acts of violence.
Killing his wife and mother and then shooting people from the University of Texas Tower. Just terrible.
Truly awful. But the key thing, the really crucial part, came out afterwards in the autopsy he actually requested.
They found something physical, didn't they?
They did. A brain tumor. And it was pressing right against his amygdala in the prefrontal cortex. The source is pretty blunt about it, saying it was, quote, without a doubt, a major factor in what he did.
Okay, wow. So right away, that just throws a wrench in the simple idea of free will, doesn't it?
Absolutely. If a physical thing like a tumor can be a major factor, well, it makes you stop and ask, okay, what is the nature of choice? How free are we, really?
So how does the source material dig into that? It goes into the neuroscience, right?
It does, yeah. It brings up these studies from places like the Max Planck Institute showing brain activity predicting a decision.
Predicting it before the person feels like they've decided.
Yes. And not just milliseconds before. We're talking seconds. Sometimes up to 10, even 11 seconds before conscious awareness kicks in.
10 seconds. That's a huge amount of time, neurologically speaking.
It really challenges how we think about deciding. The idea presented is maybe that feeling of I choose now is actually just the final output.
The end result of all these subconscious processes happening underneath? Processes we're completely unaware of.
Exactly. Totally opaque to us, as the source puts it. I mean, you don't consciously choose your next thought, do you? And try getting rid of one you don't want. It's not easy.
So the brain's already kind of leaning in a certain direction, priming the pump, maybe?
That's a good way to put it. This preconscious activity makes certain options more likely, like little traces in the brain boosting one choice over another.
And that explains that positive feedback loop they mention. Thinking about something makes you think about it more.
Seems like it, yeah. So two fundamentally opposing views. And like you said, this isn't new. Philosophers, scientists, they've argued about this for millennia because, let's be honest, science still doesn't have that complete theory of everything that definitively settles it.
Not at all. But then the essay introduces its central and probably its most unique proposition, what it calls the law of free will.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting. It doesn't just define free will. It proposes a condition for it. What is this law?
Well, the source puts it quite starkly. We have free will only if we are maintaining the free will of others.
Wow. Okay. So my freedom isn't just about me. It's like intrinsically linked to yours and everyone else's freedom. What's the deeper implication there?
It immediately implies this huge, maybe even radical need for cooperation. The source suggests free will might be a fundamental birthright, almost like, say, the capacity for procreation. But it comes with this profound condition attached.
And right after laying that out, the source makes another crucial point. Even when you are acting in a way that honors others' free will, you are absolutely not free from the effects caused by your own choices.
Exactly. Your choices, whether you consider them free or not, they have consequences. The example given is pretty powerful. Your will not to starve will almost certainly outweigh your will to avoid the chore of gathering food. You have the choice not to gather food, technically.
But you're not free from the effects of starvation.
Right. It's about prioritizing your will based on understanding those potential consequences. It's a choice, but a constrained one.
This gets even stickier when you have wills in direct conflict. The chapter uses a tough scenario. Someone wants to kill you, and you have a strong will to live. Is that just a complete stalemate? Two opposing wills clashing?
The source acknowledges it might look that way on the surface, but then it pushes us to ask, how truly free is that killer's will to kill in the first place? The essay suggests that this harmful desire is itself likely an effect of prior causes.
Oh, okay.
Maybe a perceived past violation of their own free will, maybe biological factors, maybe social conditioning. Who knows? The chain of cause and effect again.
So the idea isn't to excuse the harmful action, not at all, but to see it perhaps as a symptom of underlying causes, maybe past disharmony. And addressing those causes, trying to restore balance, might be the way forward, rather than just seeing it as an irreducible clash of wills.
Exactly. And the source uses these really vivid, almost unavoidable examples to show how cause and effect dramatically impact our choices and our perceived free will.
Like that car accident example. A child suddenly darts into the road. The driver's will to just keep driving conflicts instantly with the parent's desperate will for their child's safety. Both are caught in this horrible, inevitable effect of prior causes.
Yeah.
And their options, their perceived freedom in that split second, are just instantly and drastically reduced.
Or the tsunami example.
Yeah.
You know, a parent works hard, makes choices leading to a high-paying job that's cause and effect so they can exercise their will to give their child a specific education. Then, boom, an external cause, completely unrelated to tsunami hits.
Right.
Causes economic collapse. The parent loses the job that's an effect, and suddenly the child loses the choice of that private school.
Mm-hmm.
Their free will regarding the education, something seemingly personal, got directly overridden by a chain of events totally outside their control.
These examples really hammer home how external forces, just the basic flow of cause and effect in the world, can profoundly limit our options, even if we still technically have some kind of choice among the few possibilities left.
Which brings us neatly to the conditions the source identifies where our free will is actually lessened. What are some of those factors it highlights?
Well, one is simply navigating complex or uncertain situations. Think about trying to understand modern social systems or, you know, bureaucracy. Your choices can feel limited or obscure, even if they're technically there somewhere.
Yeah, that's a big one. Another significant factor mentioned is a lack of self-awareness. And the source makes a really striking point here. We generally don't teach psychology as a core subject in schools.
Right.
Yet we hold quite young children, like the example cited of 10-year-olds in Australia's Northern Territory, fully criminally responsible for their actions.
It highlights a huge disconnect, doesn't it? We expect this complex understanding of consequence and motivation from minds that haven't even been given the basic tools to understand how minds, including their own, actually work.
Precisely. And then there's learning through imitation, what psychologists call social learning theory. That also lessens our free will, apparently. We often adopt behaviors, beliefs, even emotional responses just by observing others, sometimes without any conscious decision. Think about picking up an accent or habits from friends.
It's almost automatic, yeah. Like osmosis sometimes.
And experiencing cognitive dissonance is another one. You know that uncomfortable feeling you get when your beliefs clash with your actions. To resolve that discomfort, you might change your belief or justify the action, often leading you down a path that wasn't necessarily your free preference, but one driven by the need to reduce that internal static.
Like knowing smoking is bad for you, but doing it anyway. And then maybe convincing yourself it helps manage stress just to make it feel okay. The choice to smoke might become less about truly wanting a cigarette and more about resolving that internal conflict.
Exactly. So when you layer all these factors, complex systems, lack of self-awareness, imitation, cognitive dissonance, plus that endless chain of cause and effect we talked about, well, the source concludes that many humans might actually operate with quite limited or perhaps even effectively no free will much of the time. Similar perhaps to other life forms we don't typically attribute full free will to.
Wow. That's a pretty heavy thought. But the essay then connects this understanding to something really human. Forgiveness.
It does. Recognizing that others might be acting not out of pure malicious free will, but because they're influenced and constrained by all these pervasive factors, well, it can make it easier to view their actions as effects of deeper causes and limitations. It might open the door to more compassionate understanding, maybe make forgiveness a bit easier.
It really sharpens that distinction between simply having a choice, you know, any option at all, and having truly free will, meaning viable alternatives that aren't dictated by overwhelming external or internal pressures.
The source's example of someone in a developing nation taking a desperately low-paid job is perfect here. They technically choose that job over starvation. But is it a free choice when the alternative is an existential threat? This connects back to ideas we've discussed before about structural violence, right? Where the system itself kind of coerces people's choices.
Definitely. And the essay points to another powerful, often unseen force influencing our choices. Advertising.
Oh, yeah. It argues advertising often operates on an unconscious level. It uses techniques like positive reward cues, repetition, to build these automatic associations and biases in our minds. So even when you think you're critically evaluating an ad,
you think you're immune.
Right. But the underlying influence might already be at work, subtly shaping your desires below your conscious awareness.
The research mentioned Custer's and Arts. That's fascinating, suggesting we should actually be more cautious of the ads we can see, because our minds are processing them in ways we aren't consciously controlling. Just seeing the ad apparently creates bias. The only real way to negate its unconscious influence is to avoid seeing it altogether.
Which, as the source points out, has massive implications, particularly when advertising promotes things that are maybe detrimental to public health, a topic we touched on back in topic 14.
Okay, so we have all these arguments piling up, suggesting our free will is limited, maybe even an illusion, and that determinism might be the fundamental reality. Yet, the source presents this remarkable paradox about how we must live.
It does. It argues that even if determinism is true and our choices are just the inevitable outcome of long causal chains, we must still make decisions as if we have complete free will.
Why? That seems counterintuitive. If it's an illusion, why not just, I don't know, relax and go with the flow?
Because, fundamentally, in our lived experience, we have no other choice. We operate within the framework, illusion or not. From our subjective viewpoint, our choices feel real. They feel like they matter. They have real consequences we experience.
And beyond just that practical necessity, there's research highlighting significant psychological benefits to believing in free will, right?
Absolutely. Studies like those by Rigoni and others mentioned show that believing you have control over your life is strongly associated with greater happiness, motivation, better job performance, just overall better psychological health.
And conversely, there's research from people like Baumeister, Vose, or even philosophical arguments from thinkers like Sam Harris, suggesting negative outcomes when people disbelieve in free will. Things like changes in brain activity related to voluntary action, an increased likelihood of cheating, less helpful counterfactual thinking.
Right, that's that crucial mental process of imagining what if, which is essential for learning from mistakes. If you don't believe your choices matter, why bother thinking about alternatives?
So, it seems, regardless of the ultimate philosophical truth, which we might never know for sure, operating as if our choices matter is vital for a functioning, healthy individual in society.
It certainly seems that way based on the evidence presented.
Okay, so we've wrestled with the complexities and the potential limitations of free will. Let's pivot now to the second part of the chapter title, Leading by Example. How does this connect back to that law of free will we discussed?
Well, the essay shifts gears by first acknowledging a common and pretty profound piece of wisdom. You hear it in phrases like, we cannot change others, or maybe Gandhi's famous line, be the change you wish to see in the world.
Right. You can't just force someone to alter their core beliefs or behavior, even if you're convinced it's for their own good. It rarely works, does it?
Exactly. Because attempting to force or coerce someone fundamentally violates their free will, which, according to the law proposed in the source, is the very thing we need to uphold to maintain our own. Yeah. So how can you ethically influence others, according to this text?
Okay, so not through force or fear. It says you need to first gain permission for their attention or curiosity, something we explored back in topic 13 about earning attention.
Precisely. Get their buy-in first. And then you can offer information. The text describes it as planting seeds of thought, or perhaps most powerfully, you influence them by simply leading by example, by embodying the change yourself.
So you plant the seed, you live your life according to your principles, but you can't force them to water it or make it grow. They have to choose to cultivate it themselves.
That's the idea. Change, from this perspective, only truly happens within another person through their own free will. Or maybe what a determinist might call causationally inspired curiosity, a curiosity that arose inevitably from prior events influencing them to pay attention to your example or information.
This really highlights the incredible, maybe sometimes unnoticed, power of our own behavior. Whether we intend it or not, our actions are constantly serving as a model for others.
It's happening all the time, isn't it? And the source notes that less mature individuals, like children especially, are particularly prone to mimicking those around them, sometimes even doing what they see rather than what they're explicitly told.
It's just a fundamental way we learn and develop socially. And the essay throws in a kind of surprising detail to underscore just how pervasive this modeling effect is. It's not even limited to humans copying other humans.
No. It mentions examples of animals mimicking humans, like Nora, the famous piano-playing cat, or dogs imitating quirky behaviors of their owners. It just illustrates that this dynamic of influence through example is a really widespread pattern in nature, not just some human social quirk.
Which really underlines the point that true social isolation is virtually impossible on Earth. We're constantly embedded in this web of influence, both giving and receiving examples, consciously or unconsciously.
And our collective examples are what ultimately contribute to shaping what we perceive as societal norms. Everything from fashion trends to laws to basic everyday etiquette evolves because people set examples, others observe and follow or react, and these patterns solidify over time.
So by extension, when we exhibit behaviors that are maybe disharmonious, impatient, or inconsiderate, we are, in a small way perhaps, normalizing those patterns for others around us. This connects back to ideas about cultural relativism, which we talked about in Topic 7, how norms vary wildly based on the examples prevalent in a given society.
Exactly. Our individual actions aren't just isolated events. They are continuously shaping the environment of examples from which others draw, subtly influencing what seems normal, acceptable, or even possible to them.
You know, even this deep dive, and the essay itself is presented as an example, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It frames itself as an exercise in mindfulness, driven by curiosity, and explicitly appreciates the listener's investment of attention respecting their choice to engage.
It absolutely is. It's trying to practice what it describes, offering information and a particular way of looking at reality as a potential seed of thought, hoping it resonates with your curiosity and your free will to explore it further or not.
Now, the chapter briefly touches on various religious and spiritual perspectives related to these core ideas,
acknowledging that historically, spiritual leaders and traditions often filled roles similar to early psychologists or social scientists, making deep observations about human nature, motivation, and interaction.
And when you look at the themes highlighted, it's quite striking how some core ideas align across these very different ancient traditions and the modern concepts discussed in Chapter 15.
It really is. Take Christianity, for instance. The texts mentioned discuss things like not causing others to stumble with your choices, which aligns directly with respecting their autonomy and free will. There's the idea of asking and seeking, suggesting an element of free will in the pursuit of understanding or connection. And critically, there's a very strong emphasis on leaders and followers being models for each other, leading by example.
Then you have Muslim texts mentioned, touching on the consequences of one's deeds and the concept of being a servant, which hints at actions having definite results and perhaps limits to individual will within a larger divine framework.
Buddhism, of course, directly addresses cause and effect through karma and the principle of dependent origination, showing how choices are always influenced by pre-existing conditions, acknowledging agency, but seeing it within this incredibly complex web of causality. And like Christianity, Buddhism strongly features leading by example. Texts describe teachers needing to master themselves first to effectively guide others and emphasize the importance of good leaders being good examples.
The Hindu tradition, particularly in the Bhagavad Gita passages cited, is very explicit about leading by example. It talks about wise individuals setting standards that inspire others to act rightly. It also includes passages about individual choice. Krishna telling Arjuna, do as you wish, after explaining everything, and highlights the importance of the listener's desire or permission to receive knowledge, which links back to that idea of attention and free will in learning.
And even other spiritual paths mentioned, like the Law of One Material, explicitly frame free will as absolutely fundamental to existence and the engine of growth and polarity. They strongly reinforce that influence should only happen when requested, respecting permission, and that personal growth is ultimately a self-directed process. Others can only provide catalyst or inspiration, echoing that core idea that you can't force change, you influence through example and information when invited.
It is truly remarkable when you lay it out like that, how these core observations about consequences, the complex nature of individual will, the necessity of respecting others' autonomy, and the undeniable power of leading by example just keep appearing across such diverse traditions over vast stretches of history.
It really suggests these aren't just, you know, recent psychological theories cooked up in the lab. They seem to be fundamental patterns of reality that different cultures and belief systems have been observing and grappling with for millennia, each finding their own language to describe them.
So to kind of wrap up this deep dive and bring it all together, the key takeaways from Chapter 15 seem to be, first, the nature of free will is incredibly complex, deeply debated, and heavily influenced by a tangled web of internal factors, external pressures, and that long chain of cause and effect.
Right. And second, despite all the philosophical uncertainty, acting as if we have free will seems crucial, even empirically linked to greater well-being and more effective functioning in the world.
Third, the essay proposes that provocative law of free will, suggesting our freedom, is somehow conditional on maintaining the freedom of others, implying a deep need for cooperation.
And finally, while that law might constrain direct interference, the practical, ethical way to influence others positively is not through force or coercion, but by offering information as seeds for their own consideration, and most powerfully, by living your own life as a consistent example.
This entire exercise, really this whole series of deep dives into unraveling the fabric of fear, is about trying to understand these fundamental patterns that shape our reality and our experience within it.
Which leaves us, and you, with a final thought to maybe mull over. Given how much our perceived free will might be shaped by unconscious processes, by external pressures, by that whole history of cause and effect stretching back, how does that change how you view personal responsibility, both for your own actions and, perhaps more challengingly, for the actions of others?
And tied to that, knowing that your behavior, even in small everyday moments, serves as an undeniable example for those around you, shaping their reality in subtle ways. What minor shift, what small change might you choose to embody today, driven by your own free will, your own curiosity, your own desire to lead by a slightly different example?
That concludes the 2025 deep dive of unraveling the fabric of fear, but don't stop here. Continue the cathartic journey, stay curious, and get involved with Cathartic Curiosity.